How are regulations damaging markets? Today on The Curious Task, I'm speaking with Bryce Tingle. Welcome to The Curious Task from the Institute for Liberal Studies, where we explore economics, politics, philosophy, and other ideas from a classical liberal perspective. I'm Alex Aragona, your host, and today I'm speaking with Bryce Tingle. Bryce holds the N. Murray Edwards Chair in Business Law at the University of Calgary. He is a member of the founding teams for several companies active in the technology, energy, and financial industry. He also advises several private and public companies. He is the author of several academic publications as well, of course, one of which will be the focus of our conversation today, called Returning Markets to the Center of Corporate Law. Bryce, welcome to The Curious Task.
Thank you. I've been a long-time listener. I'm really pleased to be able to talk to you, Alex.
It's great to have you on, Bryce. And for those of you listening, if you actually do pay careful attention to the patron readout that we do sometimes at the break, Bryce's name has come up multiple times. So we have both a fan and a supporter of the podcast on, so that's great. And Bryce, as you very well know, we base each episode on a question and go over the answers and conversation takes us. Our question and theme today is, how are regulations damaging markets? And you know, as for starting today's conversation, especially since a lot of your work deals with corporations, the structure of corporations, corporate law, and so on, I like to get into some context before we get into like the main theme. I don't think we've actually had someone that's sort of an expert on corporate law, commercial law, et cetera, before. So you might think it funny me starting us where I'm going to start us, but I think it's actually going to be a great sort of omnibus episode in a certain way. There is a method to my madness, so trust me. So from a context setting perspective, this is going to be one of our corporate law episodes. What is a corporation?
Yeah, that's a great question to start off with. So a corporation is a legal fiction. It's something that we invented. And economists who study economic history actually think it may be one of the most important things that we invented. Briefly, what a corporation allows you to do is it creates a what we call a legal person. That means that a corporation has many of the same legal rights as a human being. It can sue, it can be sued, it can own property, it can enter into contracts. And in the United States, for example, and to a certain extent here in Canada, even has constitutional rights, like a right to free speech. In the United States, somewhat more controversial in certain circumstances, it can have a right to freedom of religion. So it is a person that is a fiction. And what makes the corporation so valuable is, historically, is that it allows you to gather money from a large group of people, bring it into one organization with one set of purposes, one strategy, have professional managers who are experts in whatever the corporation is going to do, which often the shareholders are not, have experts manage that money and the business of the corporation. Because the corporation essentially lives forever, unless it goes bankrupt or is wound up with the approval of the shareholders, the corporation can grow quite large and can undertake multiple activities. Prior to our inventing the corporation, the most common economic form was either just a lone individual working on their own, which, of course, didn't allow much for the pooling of capital, which meant that the person who provided the capital and the person who managed the business was exactly the one and the same person. And when the person died, the business died. The only alternative to that was a partnership. If a business project was too big for a lone individual to take on their own, then the only alternative was to create a partnership. And a partnership had a lot of the same problems with an individual that an individual did have going to business. You had more people, so you could raise more capital. But because individuals could get sued for any debt of the partnership, practically speaking, that really limited the amount of money you could get from people because they were putting their neck on the line. As well, the law said that, look, if people are going to be liable for the actions of the partnership, then we need to give them authority over what the partnership did. So you had a lot of people involved in the businesses of the partnership, and that tended to also keep them quite small. And then partnerships not only ceased to exist when one of the partners died, they often ceased to exist whenever the project was over. So for example, in the Middle East, long, risky trading voyages to China, let's say, were conducted by partnerships, and you'd have a different partnership for every voyage. In contrast, when the British government chartered, say, the Hudson Bay Company or the East India Company, those companies lasted for, of course, hundreds of years. They allowed the pooling of vast amounts of money from a large group of people who didn't feel they needed to be involved in the management of the company because only their investment was at risk. They weren't personally at risk if Hudson Bay Company, for Hudson Bay Company debts. And around this corporate form, we invented a lot of things designed to make corporations work, like a financial press, like a stock exchange to allow people to trade their shares. Generally speaking, corporations is probably one of the most important things we've ever done in law.
In law, and speaking, and you touched on already, can we push into a little further too? Because I think some people get tripped up on this too. You were already sort of treading into the concept of limited liability, essentially. So, which is what distinguishes, like, I mean, one of the things that distinguishes a corporation from how like a sole proprietor could operate. Could you just go into limited liability a little more? Because I think a lot of people get confused about this one.
Yeah, sure. So the when we say that a corporation's a person, we mean it. We mean that the debts of the corporation belong to the corporation. They don't belong to any other person. And so, in particular, they don't belong to the shareholders. That's unlike a partnership or a sole proprietorship, where if I am, which is just if I'm doing business on my own. So if myself and a friend were making shoes, and then we buy too much leather, it gets spoiled, or we make ugly shoes, we're unable to sell them, and we owe people a bunch of money, they can come and sue us not just for the money that's in that little shoemaking business, they can sue me for my house, my car, my tools, everything else I own. That's not the case with a corporation. You put money into a corporation, and then you could lose that money for sure if the corporation goes bankrupt, but no one can come after you for any additional money. So that's what we mean by limited liability.
Excellent. And treading a little further towards sort of some of the meat of the matter we're going to cover today, we set some good context for what a corporation is and how it sort of operates. When most people think of regulations on the structure and dealings of corporations or how corporations exist in the modern economy, if you will, I know it's very broad, but think of it that way. People often also just think on the state and legislation side, right? If someone says, oh, there should be a rule about corporations to do X, Y, and Z, let's talk to, you know, the Congress people or parliamentarians or whatever, you know, these types of banks or these types of meatpacking corporations, whatever should be doing this. But, you know, it seems that that's not just what exists, right? Like there's corporate and commercial law, et cetera. Of course, I know you can't, you know, read us thousands upon hundreds of thousands of pages of corporate law to tell us everything about this. But I sort of want to establish this point too, because it'll be relevant later. What sort of corporations are regulated by is not just legislation per se, right?
Right. So let me say a couple things that people often get wrong. So there's a prejudice sometimes we have that everything that government does is a massive burden and takes away from economic freedom. I'm not saying everyone thinks that, but sometimes it's a habit of thought that people can fall into. Corporations are a good counterexample. Corporations are artificial persons, and so they wouldn't exist without legislation. They're a creature of statute. So the Business Corporations Act in each province and federally actually has the effect of increasing human freedom because they allow us to form these corporations. Similarly, so the usual rubric of is the government involved or is it not involved, that doesn't tell you anything useful really in corporate law. Similarly, we often think that, well, if a corporation is being regulated, of course it has to be coming from the government or some quasi-governmental regulatory body like a securities commission, for example. And it's true. corporations are regulated by the government in lots of different ways and lots of different areas that they do business, employment law and intellectual property and tax and those things. As well, they're regulated, particularly the area that I suspect we're going to get into, they're regulated by securities commissions, which have in the last 25 years or so gotten increasingly interested in regulating how they're governed. There are also non-governmental actors that have tremendous influence in how corporations operate. Now, some of them are large institutional shareholders. So institutional shareholders differ from regular shareholders, from you and me, in that they have lots of beneficiaries who may be, for example, teachers in the province of Ontario, who a portion of their paycheck every month is taken from them and is put into a pension fund. And the professional managers then manage that fund. But there's a difference between the economic interest holders in the fund, which are the teachers, and the professional fund managers, who are MBAs and lawyers who are involved in managing the fund. And so those third-party institutional fund managers, they have a hand in regulating business and have grown increasingly over the last 20, 25 years interested in imposing a particular set of expectations on companies. The stock exchange, which is kind of quasi-public, quasi-private, sort of bit ambiguous, it's a heavily regulated institution that's technically privately owned. The stock exchange, of course, has got sets of rules that govern the behavior of corporations on the stock exchange. And the last group, I think it's worth, and then the last really powerful group in regulating corporations are a group of private firms called proxy advisors. And proxy advisors give voting advice to the large institutional shareholders. So these shareholders may hold shares in hundreds of companies. They just don't have enough time to read everything those companies put out or come to decisions about which director ought to be voted or whether or not an executive pay package is acceptable. And so they kind of depend on the proxy advisors to do this work and tell them how to vote. Proxy advisors are controversial. I have an opinion about them we may get to later
we
in
probably
the
will.
They're an important, they are in fact so important, they're really the de facto regulators of public companies when it comes to their corporate governance, their day-to-day operations, and the way they organize themselves. And then you've got a bunch of little organizations that I think individually could be ignored by a company if they really wanted, but are tough to ignore in aggregate. And that's things like media outlets and think tanks and corporate gadflies and people with strong opinions about one thing or another corporations do, and lobbying groups and advocacy organizations who all spend a lot of time telling corporations how they ought to behave how they ought to organize themselves. And frequently, these groups try to enlist the securities commissions or the stock exchange or the institutional shareholders or the proxy advisors, the really powerful regulators of corporate behavior, they try to enlist them in whatever cause they're pushing, whether that's something like requiring carbon disclosure or requiring certain types of boards to be put in place racial, gender, and sexual diversity. They tend to do they're influential, these groups, but they wouldn't be influential on their own. They're influential for their ability to attract support from these bigger organizations I've discussed.
Mm-hmm. And one more sort of context 101 or 201, 301, et cetera, question before I jump into some more meat here. It's just one thing I, in my experience, people tend to conflate this, like not every corporation is a quote, public corporation in the sense you can buy a stock on a stock exchange or whatever. And And also as well, it seems to be the case that not every, this word public sort of gets people confused too, right? Like, right. You know, if you're a public corporation like Apple, et cetera, could you just talk about the, you know, the public private distinction a little bit and what that sort of means at a very high level? Like, for example, you and I can go create a corporation tomorrow. It doesn't mean anyone else could buy a stock in it, right? I think this trips some people up because often so much of our attention is captured by the Googles and the Alphabets and the Apples and so on of the world, right?
Yeah. So you're right. There is a big dividing line in the corporate world between companies that are public and companies that are private. A public company is a company that is listed on a stock exchange, and it's made certain filings with the Securities Commission, which allow the shareholders in that company to freely buy and sell its shares. Private companies, in contrast, are not listed on a stock exchange, and they haven't made those filings. So there are serious restrictions on who can buy and sell their shares, to the point where it's almost impossible to buy and sell shares in a private company for most people. And so we refer to those shares as illiquid. Private companies historically have tended to be smaller. And then once they start scaling up to real size, they would go public. But that's no longer the case. In the last 30 or 40 years, a category of equity capital called private equity has arisen. Some very large companies choose to stay private. So you can now find some very large private companies. So size is no longer much of a guide the way it was maybe in the 1980s. But that's the principal difference. Public companies, and because public companies allow anyone to buy and sell their shares, they tend to be most highly regulated. They're also the most visible. So if you and I had a particular issue we're really concerned about, Alex, say we wanted to appoint members of a monastic order to boards, because we thought that would improve the quality and ethics of decision-making, we would focus our attention on public companies because they're the ones that get written up in newspapers. They're the ones everyone knows. And they're sort of the standard setters for what's appropriate for other companies.
Mm-hmm. Great. So with all of that content in mind and at play, and I think that was an excellent set of context questions and settings. So thanks very much for that, Bryce, so far. I sort of want to shift our attention to a bunch of different questions. Most of them are points based off of one of your papers, Returning Markets to the Center of Corporate Law. Before I get into some specifics about that paper itself, can you just take a second to generally outline what problem the paper is really addressing? In other words, if we're talking about returning markets to the center of corporate law, you know, the inverse obviously implies markets are not at the center of corporate law. Yeah. So what problem did you detect, and what really is the main sort of focus of what you're going through in the paper before I start pushing you on a couple specifics here?
Yeah, sure. So to a stranger to corporate law and corporate governance, the paper's title seems stupid because obviously corporations are deeply enmeshed in markets. They hire their employees in markets. They source equity and debt capital from markets. They sell products in markets or services in markets. They acquire inputs like machinery and raw materials in markets. Markets constitute the entire life of a corporation. And for a long time, this was generally understood by anyone who wrote about corporations. And the value of any corporate governance initiative or any corporate law initiative tended to revolve around, does this facilitate success in the corporation's markets? Does this lead to improvements in operating and financial outcomes? What happened is in the mid-1970s, 1976 to be specific, but a very influential paper was published in 1976 called The Theory of the Firm by two scholars, Jensen and Meckling, justifiably famous. It's probably one of the most cited papers in the history of finance. And what Jensen and Meckling, what they did was they focused attention on one narrow feature of the corporation, which is the separation of ownership and control. As I mentioned earlier, the separation of ownership and control is the main reason why corporations are so valuable to us. But it leads to some obvious potential risks, namely that the shareholders would entrust their money to a management team that will be unreliable, that will, instead of spending that money in the best interest of the shareholders in the company, they'll use that money to pay themselves lavish salaries, or they'll take the opportunity to shirk, to lie around in a hammock, or they'll buy perquisites like corporate jets and live a very fancy life, or they'll, you know, misuse it in other ways. And what Jensen and Meckling did is they analogized the situation to an agent and their principal. Now, for as long as we've had the common law, we've had agency law. And that's just any time that a principal gives an agent their property, and the agent's got a certain amount of authority over that property, you have an agency relationship. And what Jensen and Meckling said is this is exactly the situation corporations are in. Shareholders have given their property into the custody of their agents, who are the corporate managers, and there's a risk the corporate managers are going to misuse it. And the costs that would accrue to the shareholders in dealing with this problem, they called agency costs, which is why the whole theory is called agency cost theory. Now, Jensen and Meckling were actually presenting what finance scholars call a partial equilibrium model, which means their paper was actually saying, let's assume every other problem a corporation has been solved.
Right.
And the only thing that's left unsolved is agent loyalty. In other words, Jensen and Meckling assumed away markets. You know, they assumed away all right. the competitive activities that in practice take up 99% of business people's time and attention during the working mm-hmm. day. And that's fine, right? I mean, economists do this all the time. What happened, though, was for a variety of reasons we can get into or not, agency cost theory was incredibly attractive to regulators and academics and business law professors. And the fact that it was a partial equilibrium model kind of was forgotten. And it became instead the main lens that we use to evaluate whether or not a corporate law or corporate regulation was a good idea. We asked ourselves, well, is it going to help manage is it going to help ensure that managers are faithful stewards of the shareholders' property? And that's, again, not the worst question in the world to ask, but it for sure isn't the only question to ask. And so the title of the paper comes about because for 30 or 40 years, we've been pursuing regulation entirely focused on this narrow question of how do we make the managers of the company better stewards of their principals, the shareholders. And we haven't spent really any time asking, is this good for the business? Do these changes actually make the company better able to compete in its markets, more agile, less risky, more successful? And so my paper says, look, as academics, as regulators, we've made this fundamental mistake. We need to consider the possibility that we've gone down the wrong path.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I sort of inferred from the paper, but of course you tell me if I'm either getting too ahead of myself or if you would obviously modify it. But it seems to me, like you said, if we take like one corporation, for example, and we're looking at that more through like this sort of idea about, like you said, it's the sort of the ownership and management discussion. It's sort of the shareholders and the officers discussion, not necessarily the operations and the markets. To me, it's like when you zoom out from that and you think of that on a scale of 100 or thousands of corporations, we're removing not only the question of how one corporation acts on a market, but we're sort of also removing the discussion or the spotlight from the overall health of a market, i.e. competitive enterprise, if you want to look at it that way, which seemed to be one of the major problems that I sort of detected if you're doing that. In other words, the spotlight sort of put on just how the corporation's structured and how it functions in other ways beyond whether or not it's however you want to enter the conversation, right? You know, servicing a good, creating prosperity en masse, whatever else, right?
Yeah, and you really see that with executives. If you ask your average business person about what they do during their day, what they, you know, stay up at night thinking about, it's almost always competitive market-based activities, you know? It's what R&D initiative to pursue, what strategy to pursue, how to keep employees, is the employee morale good enough that they're going to keep their best employees, how to recruit a new senior executive or a new technical expert, where to go to get equity financing, how to convince the bank to give an extension or to lend more money. These are the things that keep them up all night. What doesn't keep them up all night is how to make sure that they're a faithful steward of the shareholders.
Right.
When you poll them, and there have been lots of these sorts of polls, when you poll them, they think they are faithful stewards of the shareholders. They work very hard for the corporation. I've argued in other papers that, in fact, competitive markets don't allow the opportunity for much deviation from, you know, hard-driving, profit-making activities. So they would say, I don't even know what you're talking about. We're not living in a place where I could take my eye off the ball for very long without it taking the company down. And so most of their reaction to what we've done over the last 30 years, especially 30 years, is just weary resignation. They don't really see it as being especially relevant to anything that matters. It seems like a sideshow to the main business of their days. So you get at a good point, Alex. There is a real gulf between the people who work on corporate governance regulation and the people they're regulating.
Mm-hmm. And one of the sort of course, after I read the paper, and it's not exactly two pages, which is fine for me. I love that kind of stuff. But as far as the episode, I have to figure out a way to summarize it. Thankfully, I love it when there's a good abstract or good instro, because after I read the whole thing and before I prepare for these types of stuff, sometimes I go, okay, like, what am I going to focus on? And I like there was actually a part in the front end that sort of, you know, obviously broke that down into sort of three points, which I want to get us into further here. You know, again, in our train of thought about returning markets to the center of how we actually think about corporations, corporate law, et cetera, you're talking about, you know, you argue at least on point one that, you know, given that well-functioning markets are socially important, so we can talk about that in a sec too, yeah. But, you know, that also means we have to think of that independent of the wealth creation function of a corporation. And therefore, you know, markets themselves are socially important, also independent of their wealth creating function. So can we talk a bit about, just connecting the dot here, how the sort of focus on the officer ownership thing, shareholder, CEO type thing, like, is that sort of focus on that type of structure of the corporation sort of, you know, distracts us a little bit from that socially important aspects of markets?
Yeah, sure. So let me tell you a problem with economics. I suspect most people on the Curious Task don't start a sentence with problems with economics. The problem with economics is they're focused on efficiency. And that's especially true when economics makes its way into public policy and law. So there's a movement called Law and Economics. It's mostly focused on maximizing efficiency. And look, efficiency is incredibly important. I mean, the reason we're not living in hovels like our ancestors did 300 years ago in Europe or wherever in the world they were is because we have become significantly more efficient. Efficiency and productivity gains is what leads to virtually every good thing in our material lives. I don't think economics is wrong to focus on efficiency. The problem is that markets, the output of markets, the outcomes of markets tend to be efficient. If there's anything we know at the end of the 20th century, it has to be that efforts to find an alternative way of allocating goods and making decisions in markets did not work out very well. It produced poor countries and a lot of corruption. So markets are generally very good at producing efficient outcomes. Mm-hmm. But the actual behavior of market actors is often not efficient. A market is made up of people trying experiments, doing stupid things, making bets that fail, bargaining at length with each other. It is a messy, time-consuming, inefficient process, the outcome of which is decisions that are better than any centralized authority could make. But often when the law has gotten involved, looking at an area through an economic lens, as we have in corporate law since the agency cost theory papers sort of set the agenda, we have seen lots of inefficiencies and decided, oh, well, we could use the law to make that more efficient. Rather than having people bargain in this way and we think maybe the bargaining isn't working out well, we will make it more efficient by just saying, look, it just has to be this way. So I'll give you a concrete example. For most of the 20th century until the 1980s, the board of directors of most companies, the majority of those directors were what we call inside directors. That means they were employees or officers of the company itself. So the CEO would be on there, as would three or four other inside directors. And then you'd have a couple outside directors, who weren't employed by the company, who had no real financial connection to the company. So that was the case up until, let's say, the late 1970s, early 1980s. And then under the influence of agency theory, we looked at these boards and go, well, it doesn't make any sense. If we're worried about the CEO misusing shareholder money, we can't have him and his buddies be on the board of directors overseeing his activities. That's like leaving the child in charge of the cookie jar.
Right.
What we need to do is we need to bring in outside directors, people with no financial interest who are independent of the CEO, and put them on the board. And these independent directors will, stare at the CEO and then stare at the cookie jar and slap him every time his hand starts moving in that towards the jar. So that made a lot of sense. And so we faced initially the question of, well, look, if this is the right thing to do, why aren't companies doing that? Why are there so many non-independent directors on the board? And we decided, well, it has to be because something's broken down in the marketplace. The CEO's got too much power, or the shareholders are too weak, or for whatever reason, we have this really inefficient structure, and the efficiency, we reduce agency costs by a lot more, make the whole system more efficient if we just mandated directors. And so in lots of different ways, using various different types of pressure and regulations, we did this. And nowadays, in most companies, we've gone well past having majority independent boards. We now have super majority independent boards. And I think among the biggest Canadian companies, you'd find that every director is independent except the CEO. And that's true for about 60% of American companies. There's only one inside director and that's the CEO. So we the last 30 or 40 years have completely changed the composition of boards. And we did this because we thought, the market that generated boards, the governance market was broken, or at least hopelessly inefficient, and we were going to create efficiency. So that's the sort of thing we've done over and over and over again in corporate governance. We've seen arrangements that have persisted for many decades. We've thought we can improve on those, often because we think this will reduce agency costs more effectively than the existing systems. And we've changed We just passed laws, or we've applied pressure in different ways in order to accomplish this. Mm-hmm. So I think it's important to understand that's the nature of economics. Economics is interested in efficiency, not often in markets. In fact, very famous Nobel Prize winning economists who look at institutions like Ronald Coase or Douglas North have both at one time or another said, look, for economics, markets, even though they lie at the center of economics, they're kind of a black box. We don't spend a lot of time looking at the actual institutional characteristics of markets.
Mm-hmm. And I have actually a good chunk of follow-ups to that, but I did just keep an eye on the time. So we are going to have to take a break right there. So everyone, you're listening to The Curious Task. I'm speaking with Bryce Tingle today. The Curious Task is a podcast from the Institute for Liberal Studies. Feel free to send questions, feedback, guest recommendations, or anything else that's on your mind to curioustask@liberalstudies.ca. As always, a huge thanks to our supporters on Patreon, including Randy T. Simmons, Travis Smith, and John Robson. Remember to like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at The Curious Task, rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever else you're listening to The Curious Task, and check out the Institute for Liberal Studies. Welcome back, everyone. You're listening to Curious Task. I'm speaking with Bryce Tingle today. So Bryce, I think that the first half was great. I mean, we were on a good train of thought there. I had to put sort of a break in between in the interest of time. But with that out of the way, I want to jump in on a couple of things here. You answered sort of the pillar that I sort of threw at you before the break there quite well. I want to shift gears a little bit further into another sort of train of thought that your paper talks about. And of course, it's related to what you were just on there too, but pushing further a little more specific into some of these things here. Now, one of the things you highlight as well is this regulatory preoccupation, and the way you term it, with maximizing wealth has had the practical effect of adversely affecting the operation of markets. Now, we just spent a good chunk of time talking about, you know, how corporations are viewed like within a market, or rather their sort of lack of being viewed from a market perspective and more from an institutional sort of arrangement perspective. But this interesting point about this sort of way of looking at corporations and this regulatory approach with, quote, maximizing wealth, and that having the effect of adversely affecting operation on markets, some people might find that just sort of in and of itself counterintuitive. A lot of people actually, back to the economists or those that are interested in those type of topics, often sort of just celebrate that as like a sort of full stop, end the telegram point of, look, corporations, they create wealth. You can get, you know, look at the open markets and shareholders and so on and so forth. But putting sort of a preoccupation with maximizing wealth against how that can actually affect the health and good operation of markets, at least from a corporate law perspective, what's going on there? What do you mean by that?
Sure. So maximizing wealth, and usually it's shareholder wealth that we're talking about in corporate law, that's just a flip side. That's just another way of saying that we want efficiency. Economics wants efficiency. In that paper, I make two claims. One is that we have used maximizing shareholder value or shareholder wealth or increasing efficiency. We have used this as a rationale to intervene many, many times in the way corporations are governed. And just to give you an idea of the scale of our interventions, there is one of the proxy advisors ranks companies based on how well they're governed. And this involves ranking the companies against 96 best practices. So there are 96 different things a company is supposed to be doing if it wanted to get a 100% score from this proxy advisor. So we're not talking small interventions. We're talking lots and lots of interventions. Some of them at a very granular level. All of them new. Of the 96 best practices, you know, there would have been 10 in the 1980s. So we have, one scholar refers to what we've gone through as a 100-year flood of law reform in the area of corporate governance. I think people who aren't in the area underestimate just how big the changes we've gone through have been. So we've made these big changes, and the goal has been to produce more shareholder wealth by controlling agency costs. One of my arguments is it hasn't done this. In a way that's very familiar to anyone who studies regulation of markets, success is almost never guaranteed. And when we look at this point, a vast empirical literature about the outcomes of each of these governance strategies, we find none of them have worked the way we expected. Some of them have been value destroying. Many of them have just not been value accretive. So that's the first argument about it I make. The second argument I make is that markets as an institution are inherently valuable. Even holding aside their economic consequences, you know, their wealth creation, markets are intrinsically valuable for the way that they generate innovation and social capital, and their moral influence. You'd asked sort of about this before the break, and I hadn't gotten to it. So if you're interested, I'll talk about this feature of markets because I find it fascinating and little understood.
Of course.
So there's a long tradition in the West of viewing markets as primarily good for their moral influence as opposed to their economic outcomes. This sounds very strange to modern ears, but I'm going to try and make the case. Mm-hmm. So this tradition begins with Montesquieu, and based on something he wrote, it's called the due commerce, the kind commerce tradition. And Adam Smith was a participant in this tradition. John Stuart Mill explicitly said that he thought the moral effects of markets were more important than the economic or the wealth impact of right. markets. So this is a long tradition. It fell out of favor in the 20th century. Mm-hmm. But interestingly, in the late 20th century, so the idea behind this was that markets provide several things that no other institution does. They provide, first of all, by obliging people to work together, to cooperate, to freely bargain with each other. They require, you can't bargain successfully with someone that you don't believe is an equal, or mm-hmm. at least to really convincingly pretend is an equal. In fact, if you're trying to sell them something, everybody who's been in the position trying to sell them something knows that you kind of have to treat them like a king. You're catering to what they need. It's one reason why European aristocrats look down on people in trade, because mm-hmm. it'd be literally beneath your dignity to have to lower yourself to catering to the whims of some purchaser.
Right.
So there's a certain amount of humility and empathy that's required in order to effectively sell someone something or to work out a deal with someone, to work out a bargain with someone. You have to put them in their shoes. You have to see the world the way they do. You have to give, you know, you have to treat them as an equal. You can't force them to give up whatever it is. You've got to give them something they really think is as valuable as what you're asking them to give up. Mm-hmm. So this cooperation, this trusting other people, being trustworthy, they thought that this made a major difference in the moral character of people who participated in markets. And the second aspect of the due commerce thesis, I guess, is that markets provide a modus vivendi for us to all get along with each other, that we don't have to agree on fundamental things, which is impossible, especially in a multicultural society like Canada's. Right. And we don't have to love one another, which is the province only of saints.
Right.
But that markets allow us to just get along, even in our disagreements, even with the fact that we don't love one another. There's a famous line in Voltaire's letters letters from the English, where he talks about watching the traders come out of the Royal Exchange and noticing how Jews and Muslims and Christians of many different sects all managed to put aside their really fundamental religious differences and just get along. And he was in order to trade, in order to make a living. And he was writing to a place, France, which had recently massacred people in an effort to achieve sort of ideological uniformity.
Right.
And he was saying, look, there is a much better way of getting along represented by the Royal Exchange than we have been pursuing. So it's a sort of classic work of Enlightenment, a call for toleration.
Right.
So those are the two parts of the Due Commerce thesis. What is interesting is, for most of the time that the Due Commerce thesis was influencing people like John Stuart Mill, you couldn't really tell if it was true. I mean, anecdotally, you could stand outside the Royal Exchange and see everyone getting along in a way they weren't in other circumstances in Europe. But the truth was, you had no way to really prove it or demonstrate it convincingly. In the last 40 years, 30 years, we have developed ways of testing it. There is an entire body of psychology, social psychology, political science, and economics that use games and exchange, I guess they're all games, one sort or another, that are designed to measure how trustworthy a person is, how trusting they are, how well they cooperate. And there's probably a dozen games that have been used. Half a dozen tend to get used a lot. People may know the ultimatum game. This is a game where there are two subjects of the experiment. The scientist comes in, gives one of them, let's say, $100. And says to this subject, call him Subject A, Subject A, you can do anything you want with this money, but you got to split it at least in some way with Subject B. If Subject B, you accept the split, then both of you get to keep the money and you walk away. But if Subject B rejects the split, then I'm coming and taking $100 away. So if you start with the assumption that people are always maximizing on the margin, they're always acting in the strongly self-interested way that sometimes we caricature human beings. What you'd expect, of course, is Subject A gets $100. She keeps $99, the maximum for herself, and she gives it to Subject B, $1. And Subject B accepts that deal because if he says no, then he loses the dollar. He's better off with the dollar. What we find, of course, is that people don't behave that way. Subject A tends to split the money pretty close to even. And if Subject A doesn't, Subject B will often reject the split, even though that means he's harming himself just to see that justice is done, that an unfair split is punished. Subject A doesn't get away with it. So they do these, and there's versions of this game and other games where they depend on cooperation, and there's versions of this game where you play the game over and over again, and so you can kind of see how people's decision-making evolves, and there's versions of the game where people's decisions are kept secret. None of that is important. The only thing that's important to know is these studies tend to do a very good job of predicting how people will cooperate, predicting what we call social capital. Let's go social capital, at least partly social capital. Social trust and trustworthiness.
Mm-hmm.
They have run these studies. There are dozens of studies, including some of the largest studies ever performed in behavioral economics across many, many different cultures. What we find from these studies is that the single institution that best predicts pro-social behavior, cooperating, trustworthiness, etc., is exposure to markets.
Mm-hmm.
And they've looked at this in lots of different ways. They've compared the behavior of university undergraduates to business executives, and they found that business executives are much more trustworthy. than university students. Bit of a blow there. They look at traditional societies, and they measure how many, what percentage of a person's calories comes from food they buy in a market versus food they find or make for themselves. And in every case, the more market exposure the person has, the more pro-social the behavior, the more willing they are to trust strangers, and the more willing they are to be trustworthy in turn. And so kind of without noticing it, we have been testing the due commerce theory for the last 30 years. And at this point, it's very difficult to criticize. It seems like markets really do produce these kinds of moral outcomes in people, and obviously very valuable outcomes for our society. The other thing that we've done is we've been able to collect a lot of data on questions of tolerance and respect for human rights and civil wars and genocides or other kinds of massacres. Mm-hmm. And again, that data, because you don't tend to have randomized controls for those sorts of studies, they're not as probative as these other studies, but there's still at this point kind of overwhelming evidence that it's markets more than anything else, any other institution we can name, that predicts high levels of tolerance in a society. So, for example, markets are a much better predictor of tolerance and social and civic peace than whether or not the country is a democracy or not. Mm-hmm. To give you one example that was surprising to me. So, in other words, and just to summarize, it turns out markets, even if they didn't produce more wealth, which they definitely do, it turns out they're just valuable intrinsically. And obviously, from the standpoint of my paper, this is relevant because when we intervene in corporate governance, we are interfering with market activities. Mm-hmm. We are disrupting the process of bargaining and experimentation and being trustworthy and trusting and imposing our rule instead of all that business, saying this is actually how you're going to run your company. Mm-hmm. And I think that is intrinsically a mistake.
And actually, on that exact note, I was very interested. That whole train of thought I thought was excellent, and I'm glad it sort of ended up at this exact point because I was hoping it would actually. Because if we were to take from that, our first thought there, which is ultimately there's obviously nuances in the sense I don't want to summarize unfairly what you're saying, but sort of if more markets are better and more people participating on markets are better, I want to connect this actually up with a quote here that what happens when back to the core of your paper, when there's too much interference with the governance arrangements and so on and so forth. You said the following, and I'm just going to block quote it here, but there's one specific point that I want to get into. So you said, quote from your paper, "While wealth maximization provided corporate law scholars and regulators with a research agenda for more than 40 years, it also led to many regulatory and other interventions into the governance market, seriously damaging it. There is little evidence that today's widely held firms' governance arrangements, are the result of firm-specific bargaining or experimentation. The efficiency gains have proven elusive." And I'll just pause there and say, I think much of our conversation has already covered this, and I think we don't need to go too much further into that because I think you put a lot of great stuff here. But this next sentence back into your quote here, "The most concrete result is that fewer enterprises are interested in participating in the market at all." And that's actually the one right there I want to jump into from the train of thought we were just leaving, which is it's not only, it seems to me, that the point you're making is that, there's the focus and all the things we've been talking about, the way corporate laws work, the way we look at corporations as institutions are not market focused, and that's bad for the corporations in and of themselves. But this also results in literally less market participation by maybe would-be participants of the market and so on and so forth.
Right. So you remember, this is an excellent question, Alex. So you remember when I talked that economics has kind of got a bit of a blind spot, according to Douglas North and Ronald Coase and other economists, about the institutional arrangement of markets. one of the key things that a market needs to do is it needs to bring in buyers and sellers. It needs to provide reasons for people to come into the market, to participate in that market. And we have a governance market that, so almost all of the governance regulation I've been talking about has occurred in our public markets. There's been some trickle down to private companies, but it's mostly been a public market thing. And we have seen over the last 20 years a huge decline in the number of companies that are willing to enter our public markets. And that's the sign of a market that is failing. We've created a corporate governance market that is failing to attract the sellers, namely the managers who've got a business that they're prepared to put on the market and make available for sale to interested investors. The scale of the decline comes again as a surprise to people who don't spend a lot of time on this. So we had over 1,500 companies on the Toronto Stock Exchange 20 some odd years ago. We've got somewhere just slightly north of 700 now. Mm. The United States has lost half of the companies they had 25 years ago. And the biggest part of that isn't so much companies leaving, though companies always leave.
Right.
The biggest problem is new companies aren't going on. They don't want to. They're staying private. They're selling themselves to big companies. They're doing anything they can to avoid going to the public markets. And when we do see a company enter the public markets, for example, the United States, we see them adopting a constellation of structures that are designed as much as possible to protect themselves from the market for corporate governance that we have created. They go public with dual class shares, with staggered boards, with limited shareholder voting rights, with contractual provisions that give managers significant power. They've done everything possible, not just to avoid one thing or another they don't like about our governance regime, but to avoid it entirely. And those are the very few companies that are going public. So in the U.S., between 1980 and 2000, 360 or so companies went public every year. The number since 2000 has been, you know, around 100. So it has just been a complete collapse. And this is not a good year, bad year thing. This is a secular decline. Our public markets have just disappeared. Now, or rather, they haven't disappeared. They're in decline. Now, when I tell people this, they often don't care. But I will, if Alex, I will try to convince people to care about this dumb question of what's happening in our markets.
Yeah.
If you start a business, let's say a technology company, a software company, you're going to need to raise money in order to make that business work. And you're going to need to attract people to the business. So the money you raise, you're going to give shares to early investors. They may be family members. You may be lucky and get a venture capital investment. You raise money from a lot of different people, though. That's normal in this country in particular. Mm-hmm. And then you will also try to attract executives. You'll need a finance person. You'll try to attract a subject matter expert to lead your R&D, whatever it is. And in order to induce them to leave stable, safe places of employment to come work for your highly risky startup, you're going to give them stock options or other forms of equity. So everyone involved in that company is going to own the shares in that company. And at some point, they need to turn those shares into money. We call that an exit transaction.
Mm-hmm.
And there really are only two exit transactions. You either sell the company to another company, usually a bigger company, or you take the company public.
Mm-hmm.
Now, in Canada, in lots of sectors, we don't have big companies. So we don't have very many big technology companies. We don't have very many, if any, big pharmaceutical companies or biotech companies. So when we start up businesses in those areas, and when the time comes after 5 years that we're looking for an exit, those companies, if they don't go public, they're going to get sold, and they're going to get sold to a foreign company, usually American.
Yeah.
So in general, what's happened in Canada, and I've got a paper on this, for the last 20 some odd years, is we have invented great things in this country. We're not dumb. We've got great universities, researchers of first class. We start up businesses at about the same rate as other countries, but we sell those businesses very early in their life to foreign companies. And then those businesses are built in the United States or less often Europe. Mm-hmm. So one reason to care about the fact that our public markets are really unpleasant places, or not a pleasant place, that people are really unwilling, managers or companies are unwilling to go public, is that the only way we're going to keep these businesses and build these industries in Canada is if we have appealing public markets. There are other reasons too. Public markets provide locked-in capital, and historically that's been crucial for scaling business to particular size. These days, I mean, we're recording this just a couple weeks after the Bank of Canada said we're in a productivity crisis, that right. GDP per capita has declined right. in the last 8 years, which is astonishing. Right. We're dead last in the OECD. This is a real problem given that productivity ultimately is what determines Canadian standard of living. Mm-hmm. And our problem in Canada is a scaling problem. A guy who develops a bacteria that does something great for your health in a university lab, that invention doesn't add a penny to productivity. And if he starts up a company and begins kind of commercializing it and refining the idea with the money he can bring in from interested investors, that also doesn't add much to productivity. What adds to productivity is when he takes that company from a small business with, you know, making an initial foray into the market and scales it to a large company affecting lots of people, making lots of money, employing lots of people. Canada has a scaling problem. And historically and logically, the only place for business to scale really is public markets, because they provide locked-in capital. They give companies the freedom to work for the long term, to build themselves up.
Right.
In my view, absolute crucial economic question that Canada is facing today is very much tied to the health of our public markets. And as you say, I argue in the paper, our governance regime has very clearly made that market, you know, unattractive. And that's the key thing you need in a market. You have to encourage bargaining. You have to provide a way to resolve disputes. You have to provide methods of price discovery. There's a bunch of things you need to make a good market. But at bottom, you have to bring in the buyers and sellers.
Right.
And we're missing one of those.
Mm-hmm. Or in other words, like, you know, you say it's a scale problem. It's also literally going from private to public or whatever. If there's a disincentive to do that, it's literally a market entrance problem in a way. Right. And I think you said sometimes people might, you say that in your experience, sometimes people are like, okay, yeah, so who cares? Well, I'll just say, for my personal bias, I think this is an extremely important point and an underrated one, because the way I think of my political economy, even if we just put the hat on of like the basic middle of the road Chicago School of Economics story we tell ourselves, you can't really be, as you said, inventing something, going private, scaling and entering a market and having this great competitive enterprise story if you have incumbent, you know, multi-billion dollar multinational corporations who, as you were saying, know how to play the game and when they can enter markets with all these tricks and things and are focused more on putting resources and energy towards that, rather than just simply having an ease and an on-ramp for more participants to get into the market, right? And I think that's an incredibly crucial point, because a lot of people will often, when I talk to them, even flippantly sort of say, well, you know, like if a Canadian company is bought by an American one, or, you know, all this, you know, there's General Electric just keeps buying a bunch of people, that's the way the market goes. Well, what you're basically saying is that's not the way the market goes, because in many cases we have a problem with markets not being the center of corporate life and law, effectively, right?
Yeah. So when I started practicing law in the 1990s, most entrepreneurs wanted to go public. That was the goal. That was the goal, the exit goal. Because it meant a couple things for them. One, it meant they got to build the company. You never meet an entrepreneur who thinks that the best days of the company are behind him. They're always thinking they're just a year or two away from a real hockey stick. Because they wanted to create a new Canadian institution. They wanted to put themselves in the history books, right? You don't do that by flipping a five-year software company that no one's heard of to Google. You do that by creating a big business, employing lots of people, getting yourself in on magazine covers, you know, sort of making a difference, creating a company that's important to the country.
Right.
And you can only really do that in public markets.
Building to last, like Steve Jobs was talking about all the time in the Silicon Valley attitude of the 70s and 80s. You know, he was a proponent of that building to last, right? You're building something that's going to be around.
And so they wanted to go public. That has changed. Mm-hmm. For the most part now, it's not that those benefits of going public have changed at all. They haven't. But just the public markets, the overall risk-reward cost-benefit package of going public has been altered in a way that they just go, to hell with it. And just sell the company and not bother with that stuff.
Absolutely. I spend a lot of my time outside of podcast land and vocationally in the business world. And I think I've talked to many people around my age or whatever, even younger folks, that they don't even have their idea yet. And they're already thinking about a private exit selling to General Electric or something. You know what I mean? They're not thinking about, as you're saying, doing that sort of whole, and I don't mean this in a disparaging way. I'm talking about that whole like sort of Chicago school competitive enterprise sort of story, right? It's not about building the next Chrysler or GM anymore. It's about selling your five-year software company to one of those, which is not healthy for markets if healthy markets have more participants competing, right?
Yeah, and in Canada, as I say, it's tied to what I think every economist who studied the issue of our productivity says is our big problem, which is Canada, we fail to scale businesses and innovative industries.
Right.
So, and the place where you scale is public markets. So it just seems to me vital to figure this out.
And one last sort of question here, because we're certainly going actually a little over time of our traditional hour here, but that's okay. One more, and then I'll bring us to a formal wrap up. And you tell me if I'm sort of lobbing a football too far or whatever, but this struck me as very interesting when I read your paper, and even more now. And I'm glad I noted it for our conversation today, because even more than we had this conversation, I find it very interesting that there's a lot of folks out there that have and had, you know, harsh critiques about, you know, corporate law and corporate behavior and structure, let's say since about the 1980s, you know, and this sort of attitude came back since the financial crisis too. You know, a lot of people really sort of down and not happy with, frankly, even the fact a corporation would exist, right? Like sort of this sort of angry at sort of enterprise and corporate enterprise in the United States and Canada type attitude. Now, a lot of them, and they're not coming from the angle you're coming from, but they often will say things that corporations, how they're structured, It's all about sort of gaming ownership structure and capital and wealth creation. It's not about actual markets. A lot of this is rigged. As I was saying, lots of people who would say this are not even pro-free market, but they tend to have sometimes similar sounding critiques to some of the things we've been saying today. And I find that a lot of people who are pro-free market tend to jump down some of these people's throats, praise what corporations do, talk about the stock market and the exchange and going public as being okay and just get with the competitive enterprise thing. All that to say, I just found it interesting. I'm not even sure this is a point, but I just found it as a reflective sort of thing. It really struck me that when I listened to sort of what you were talking about here and some of the critiques some people have about the way stock exchanges going public and the current health really of corporate governance is, sometimes these two camps don't seem too diametrically opposed to me. Of course, you might run into other problems too, but it is nice to hear someone like yourself who's clearly not anti corporation or anti-market by any means, but you're saying, yeah, there actually are some problems here, and I found that really interesting.
Yeah, there are. I mean, sometimes we talk like markets arise spontaneously out of the ether, and it's true, some do. You know, there are instances where you see purely private markets arise in the Hanseatic League in the 14th century. You see black markets arise anywhere where the government is corrupt or regulations really wrong. There are markets in prisons that show up that appear. but large scale market activity between strangers, that does not happen unless you've got, you get the regulation right. You know, if it was just a case of the government getting out of the way, then we'd expect to see large scale impersonal markets in places like the Sudan or Yemen.
Right.
And we don't, right? It takes the rule of law. It takes structures in order to, you know, resolve disputes, so that, to protect property rights, to protect bargains, to require the kind of disclosure you need for a relatively efficient and truthful price discovery. You need these things. And so I don't think it's especially helpful to on either side of the political spectrum to pretend like we could somehow suddenly do away with regulation, or that the market's somehow intrinsically wrong. There are markets that work well and markets that don't work well. And the public market is currently a market that is not working well from the standpoint of attracting sellers, and not working well for Canada or the US or the UK, though I think Canada's problem, because we're so dependent on our public markets, because we're so close to the United States, I think it's a much bigger problem for us than for our trading partners. But I think I also share. So I share that in common with, you know, the people you're describing, usually on the left, who are very unhappy with markets. The other thing that I share with them is the concern that we have given too much power to the financial industry, in particular,
absolutely,
institutional shareholders. Yeah. And that's been a conscious decision, and we've done that with regulation. It doesn't have to be that way. I don't think it's inevitable. You sometimes hear people talk about finance capitalism. I think it's a nonsensical term, or late stage finance capitalism. I think it's a nonsensical term. We made the decision under agency cost theory, honestly, that the shareholders were going to be the principals and everything was going to be done to maximize their wealth. We do have research that shows that when companies manage to escape some of the things we put in place to protect the shareholders, they actually do better at things like R&D. They get lower interest rates, which means they can make more credible promises to their creditors, to the banks lending the money, basically, that they'll repay the money. They do better at retaining their employees. So we can see that some of the things we've done in our public markets, if you shift them a bit, we get better outcomes. And since, you know, Occupy Wall Street, lots of people have blamed Wall Street. I disagree with probably 90% of what they say, but there is 10% where I think, yeah, there's no reason why companies ought to be run by investment fund managers who know nothing about the business, who don't spend more than a few hours a year thinking about the business, rather than having the company run by this executives and the directors who spend every day thinking about it.
And that's very interesting, because back to wrapping it back up to the beginning of our chat, I mean, you clearly described, you know, the corporation is, you know, the stuff didn't spring out of nowhere from heaven. This is a corporation is a fictional entity that's been created, and it's regulated around and so on and so forth, you know. And of course, there are some people that think that we shouldn't even have corporations, but putting that aside for a sec, like if we are to have business corporations, and you correct me if I'm wrong, it sounds like you're saying, okay, if you're going to create that fictional entity, then yes, there is a conversation for, you've created something, what's the framework and the regulation you put around that? That's a valid discussion. And it doesn't just stop with, okay, we've created this, now just get out of the way. You think that's sort of incoherent almost.
Yeah, no, I mean, you don't get a stock market without regulation. I mean, there's just no evidence that anyone has ever successfully done it. You need some rules around what you can or can't do. You need rules about companies honestly disclosing what's going on inside them so people can buy and sell their shares. Whether we've got the regulations right or we've overregulated, these are nuanced questions that we don't have time to get into.
Right.
But what I am, you know, if people took home anything from this conversation, it would be, we have an extremely important market. We have damaged that market. And this has real consequences for Canada. And I think I would add to that, actually, market activity of the sort that used to generate corporate governance before we re-regulated it to the ground, that market activity is intrinsically valuable. It's part of what helps us Canadians get along with each other. It's how we reconcile our differences of opinion. It's how we develop the trusting pro-social behavior that the country depends on.
Great. And Bryce, obviously you're a fan of the podcast. As you said, you've subconsciously already done the last part of my outro, which is always, if everyone's going to take away one thing, what would it be? You've answered that, which is great. So I think if anything, that's a great place to leave it. I'll just say,
sure.
Bryce, thank you very much for joining me on The Curious Task today.
Really my pleasure, Alex. Thank you so much. Such good questions.
The Curious Task is a podcast from the Institute for Liberal Studies. This episode was produced by Alex Aragona, Sabine Elchidiak, and Eric Seguin. Our executive producer is Matt Bufton. The music you hear on the podcast is by Lindy Voppenfjord. You should check out his other stuff online. The Curious Task exists today because of donations of time and money from those creating it and listeners like yourself. Check us out on Patreon and find out how you can support us and get access to exclusive offers. I'm Alex Aragona, and thank you very much for joining us on The Curious Task. Thank you.